Okay, so let's dive into this issue of productivity and protein and demand and nutrition. And Bob Thompson, I just want to kind of transition to you a bit now. We remember that about 20 years ago, I think it was 1999, Chris Delgado and Mark Rosegrant at IFPRI wrote a wonderful paper on the coming livestock revolution. And can you talk more about the trends for animal protein and demand globally and give us a bit more of a context?
Yeah, thanks very much. And thanks, Jeff, for that wonderful stage setting for this session. When we look at demand, as Jeff indicated, we've got to feed something close to the equivalent of two more Chinas in the next 40 years. I think that helps him put in perspective the magnitude of the challenge just in terms of feeding numbers of people. But we've also been in a period of rapid urbanization, with half of the world's population living in cities today, projected to go to 70% by 2050. We know urbanization changes dietary patterns, usually includes more animal protein in the diet. And then we've also just come off a period of record rates of poverty reduction over the last 25 years or so in East Asia. But we see economic growth rates accelerating in South Asia and India and sub-Saharan Africa. We've got 17 countries that have averaged over 6% economic growth per year for the last decade. And we've got 20 countries in sub-Saharan Africa going to achieve 6% economic growth this year, despite the global economic slowdown. So the first thing that people do when they have additional purchasing power, low-income people do when they have purchasing power, is buy enough calories, solve the basic hunger problem. Because in the end, except in times of natural disasters or politically imposed famine, most hunger ultimately is associated with inability to access enough food because they simply lack purchasing power. So when we, as people, first solve the hunger problem, then they have the purchasing power as incomes continue to rise to include animal protein, some eggs, milk, meat, as well as fruits, vegetables, and edible oils. But so to the extent that we solve the poverty problem, get incomes rising, we make that important accomplishment of reducing hunger, but then we unleash the period of most rapid increase in demand for agricultural products as incomes rise from $1 to $2 up to about $10 or so per day. So that's the great challenge as well as opportunity. But as we see demand for food increasing by 70 to 80%, and including, in particular, more animal protein in the diet, this means that we've got to figure out how are we going to produce it. If we fail to increase supply as fast as demand, it's going to put upward pressure on prices. We know the poor spend the largest fraction of their incomes on food, and you'll increase the incidence of hunger as a result of the failure to expand supply as fast as demand is growing. Okay, so what's the potential for expanding supply? Well, first, we know that there's at most 10% more land worldwide that isn't presently forested, subject to erosion, to desertification. So if we need to increase production 70 to 80% or even doubling to satisfy the growing demand for food in the world, and we've only got 10% more land, the only sustainable future is to increase the productivity of that land that's in production. Failure to do that would involve massive destruction of forests. We lose forests, we lose wildlife habitat, we lose biodiversity, reduce carbon sequestration capacity, accelerating global warming, certainly unacceptable environmental outcomes. So the only sustainable future is one in which we raise productivity in agriculture. First, in the land, certainly also in water. Farmers use 70% of the fresh water used in the world today. If the urban population goes to 70% by 2050, there is no way the world's farmers are going to have access to 70% of the fresh water. So whatever increase in production it's going to take, we're going to have to significantly increase productivity of the water. So if we need to double the average productivity of the land, we may need to triple the crop per drop. And I think it's extremely appropriate that Professor Hillel was acknowledged at this event for his major contribution to increasing the efficiency of water use in global agriculture. But it's not only in animal or in plant agriculture, as Jeff indicated, where we need to raise productivity. I took feeds and feeding at Cornell, the basic animal nutrition course, 50 years ago. The rate of conversion that we learned of how much grain it takes to produce a pound of pork 50 years ago is double what it takes today. We've made major productivity growth, or we've had major productivity growth in animal agriculture. In dairy farming, we're producing almost five times as much milk per cow as we did at the end of World War II, and with 80% less feed. We've had immense productivity growth. But as Jeff indicated, we've got to keep raising productivity in animal agriculture as well as in plant agriculture if we're going to feed the world's larger population better than today at reasonable cost without destroying the environment. But one other point I want to hit while I have the microphone. It's not only increasing productivity that has to be addressed with urgency, it's also reducing the barriers to international agricultural trade. East and South Asia have twice as much of the world's population than of the arable land, and virtually all the arable land there is already in production. There is no scenario I can construe in which, with population, income growth, and urbanization in East and South Asia, that they're not going to need more imports from the world market to provide part of their national food security. Middle East and North Africa, of course, lack water, along with a number of other dry areas and areas that are getting drier. So when we recognize the mismatch between where the land in the world and the water, fresh water supplies are in the world with where the population is, we're going to have a larger fraction of the world's food production moving through international markets. It's neither economically efficient nor environmentally sustainable to try and be self-sufficient in all food products in every region of the world when you have such a huge mismatch between natural resource base and where the people are. So we need to reduce the barriers to international trade. We saw in 2008 when a number of countries slammed on the brakes on allowing agricultural exports to occur. This contributed significantly to the overshooting of commodity prices that occurred in the summer of 2008. So we need to raise productivity, reduce the barriers to international trade, and both of them with urgency.
Great. Thank you very much, Bob. Enthusiastic audience. This is great. Susan, I want to turn to you next. We talk about macro-level issues, trade-level issues, but what is the impact of increasing productivity, particularly with respect to protein, on nutritional outcomes for women, children, vulnerable populations?
Well, first of all, thank you, Margaret, for putting the nutrition perspective in this discussion and the role that registered dietitians play in this. There's a lot of us in this country all over the world, and we're very eager to participate in this kind of a conversation. I started my career in Cleveland, Ohio, working in the inner city, counseling young teenage pregnant women. And that was the late 60s, early 70s, and see, even way back then, we knew the importance of prenatal nutrition to the health of the mother, to the health of the child, and the health of the community. We have known this for a long time. I then went and spent the majority of my career in industry and worked with the Academy of Nutrition and Dietetics. And it is with that background that I want to share a couple of points that I think are really important for the discussion regarding nutrition. Number one, we know this is a huge, huge global issue, and it's solvable, as many, I'm sure, of your speakers have presented and as Jeff presented. The key is that nutritionists know there are two key periods of life when we need to focus our efforts. One is in pregnancy, and one is in children, 1 to 5. And the reason about pregnancy is nutrition begins right then. It begins in the womb, and every expert in the field of medicine agrees with the fact that that is where we have to lay a good foundation. Something like 17 million stillbirth children born of mothers that simply have inadequate nutrition, and that sets up the whole cascade of illnesses that occur over those years. Mental retardation, physical ailments, inability to respond to diseases that normally children would recover for. Huge problem. When you go to children, 1 to 5, when breastfeeding stops, children are then put on the diet of the culture, the community, and that's where the first thing we see is stunted growth. And while that is an indirect measure of nutritional status, it clearly is a measure that that child is undernourished and not getting enough. And what happens is, of course, we see then that cascade of stunted growth, poor muscle development, poor motor development, and cognition. And I was saying this morning to Jeff, there's a very interesting study that I recall from my many years working in industry regarding infant nutrition. And it was a work that a well-known pediatrician individual that studied the brain and metabolism of the brain. And he says, you know, the brain grows of a child. Brain grows on a once-only basis. It grows in utero, and it grows for the first 2 years of life. And the nutrients that are needed right then when that process of that brain is developing. You can't catch up. You have to have it then. And that's why nutritionists, dietitians really do recommend and urge everybody to focus on that population. That's why we see programs developed to that. So clearly we've got a problem. I know you have probably dissected the FAO report of that 870 million undernourished people around the world, primarily in developing countries. And whether one could argue whether that figure is correct or not, we would agree that it is unacceptably high and we need to do something about it. We need to do it now. So that's point number one. Point number two is that I think we know, and I just came back from the Academy of Nutrition and Dietetics meeting, and by the way, our current incoming president is sitting about four rows down, so if you've got any questions, you can ask her. But I just came back from that meeting. We had 10,000 dietitians there, and there's two things I noticed. On the agenda and the program this year, for the very first time, there was a large number of sessions devoted to world hunger. It's an issue, and it's rising, and our members know that. Secondly, the number one, when I sat in those sessions, over and over again, it was said, yeah, we got to feed calories, but it's got to be more than calories. Just calories aren't enough. It's the quality of those calories that are so important. It's the value of a high-quality diet. We tend to talk about nutrient density. Jeff's example of the egg is a perfect example of a nutrient-dense food. 6 grams of protein in one egg. That's half the requirements of a child here in the United States. That's half the protein requirements. Iron, very high in iron. High in choline, which is needed for nerve development. High in xanthine and lutein, necessary for eyes. And we could go on, and many nutrients we don't even know what they do that are contained in one egg. We need high-quality proteins. Now, our conversation over the years has kind of shifted. It's clearly calories in the United States we talk about now, overconsumption of calories. But clearly our conversations in the scientific community wane between protein, fat, and carbohydrate. Right now, we've kind of shortchanged our protein, and we need to get back and talk about it. And it is about animal protein and choices, at least for animal protein. Why animal protein? Well, we learn in basic chemistry it's got amino acids, which are necessary for all of our bodies to function, all of our cells to function, including our brains. It's got 9 of those essential amino acids that our body can't make. It's absolutely important for cell growth and for muscle and motor development. But because it's nutrient-dense, it contains other things that come along with it that are extremely important to health. It contains zinc. Zinc is found in meat. It is needed for immunity. It is needed for growth. If you open up the basic textbook of any nutrition textbook, it'll show oftentimes what happens in zinc deficiency. You can take twins that have been reared differently and fed different diets, and you'll find if it's zinc deficient, that child does not meet their growth potential. Zinc, very important, found in animal-based foods. Iron, an absorbable form of iron. You know, just because it has iron in it doesn't mean it gets into the body and it's useful. We need a heme source of iron, and that's found in animal protein as well, particularly egg yolk, particularly lean meats. We also need vitamin A. Vitamin A, blindness, 130 million children with various vision deficiencies because of lack of vitamin A. We need vitamin A, and there are many, many sources to get it. We all think of probably carrots, and clearly yellow, particularly strong orange vegetables and plant-based foods have high vitamin A, but so does dairy, and how important it is as well to get along with that particular food group. B12. Most of us don't worry about B12 because we kind of make it in our colon. But we also need B12 if, in fact, your diet's really inadequate. And that comes along with meat and milk. So there's a lot of things that come together in animal protein foods that are important. And we need to focus on certainly on more protein in the diet. Yes, clearly combining various plant bases is also an option, but it ought to be a choice that's available for people. Point number three, we talk about a balanced diet. And no doubt we need to think about all of those components together. And we know that the complexities that you all deal with in the worlds that you work in are complicated, and it's not just as easy as putting an egg on a table or making a meal with high protein. We know that there are complications, and it takes planning. It takes all technology and all the things that you are concerned about at this conference. But sometimes really simple things, little things, can make a big difference. And I would cite for you a study that's probably the most quoted in the literature. It was a study done in Kenya of children that received supplements. They were studying the effect of supplements. And they took 500 and some Kenyan children, and they fed them. There was a control group, control diet. There was a group with a supplement added that was a corn and bean-based supplement. Then we had a group with that same supplement, only milk included, and then a supplement with meat. And it was a very interesting finding, just a supplement, 5 days a week. What they found over a two-year period was those children grew. They gained weight, no doubt about that, regardless of the supplement they were on. Those small things made a difference. But the group that got the meat and the milk gained something else more important, and that was their muscle. They mid-arm muscle circumference, which is an indirect measure of muscle. They were laying down muscle because it was a high-quality protein. How important it is we provide those kinds of ingredients and food choices. The other thing is we saw B12. B12 inadequacy went away in the meat and the milk group. And, of course, cognition improved with the beef group. So what's all this say to you? It says to me that small things, something as small as that, is doable, it's preventable, and it sets children on the right course of action. And it begins to break that cycle that we see of undernourished, underfed, and poorly nourished children. We need to think about breaking that cycle. We need to think about those simple things that we can do to make a real difference in the health of the individual and the health of a community and certainly the health of the world. Thank you.
Thank you, Susan. Susan, your story there reminds me a bit about just about 2.5 years ago, I was in Guatemala speaking with a country director of a major non-governmental organization, and it just sparked my memory of, as he was telling us about the struggle with stunting in Guatemala, and the global problem of stunting is immense, but he shared with me the frustration he had with how can we get even a cup of milk a day, an egg a day, a cup of milk a day to a child, and the impact that would have. And it is widely recognized that these simple interventions, simple lifestyle changes will really make a dramatic difference.
It's
so
doable.
It is. Thank you. Let's turn to Isidro from Honduras. And before actually we get into kind of your presentation, I'd like you to just share a bit more with the audience. Talk about the nature of what you're doing. You have a much larger operation. You're not what anyone would consider a smallholder farmer. You have a number of operations that you focus on for productivity, different sectors of crop and livestock production. Can you tell us more?
Okay. Thank you for the opportunity. The last 22 years, I work at Zamorano Pan American School of Agriculture, and they encourage us professors there to be involved with the industry. And in that sense, I've been a consultant for different farmers, especially beef cattle farmers, dairy farmers, and all the feed crops that support that industry or those industries. At the farm level, we work with dairy. We are milking 400 cows. We are milking, we are growing close to 500 steers. We're doing sugar cane as a main feed crop for them. And We're doing also maize, production of maize in large operation for food and for feed. And we're also doing coffee. We have about 100 acres right now of coffee, and we're growing in that because of the opportunities.
Very important group right there. Excellent. Well, why don't you talk a bit more from your perspective in Central America, Honduras, and many countries in Central America. We'd like to hear a little bit more about perhaps the livelihoods aspect of productivity, the impact that this can have, particularly for women farmers, as they can increase productivity of whatever it is they're growing, crops, livestock, hens. What's the importance of that for women and the health and nutrition of their families and their livelihoods?
In Latin America, we don't see as much participation of women as we or as I experience here in the dialogues in Africa, for example. But anyway, the women that are involved in the animal industry, it doesn't matter if they are producing eggs or they are producing milk. It provides a cash flow for them. It provides an opportunity for them to get involved into an industry that it has a good cash flow, a daily cash flow. And that enables them and empowers them to feed their families, to become active in their economies and community economies. It's known that when you move $1 in the milk industry, you're usually moving anywhere from $2 to $3 in other services and in other industries that are related to the community. So if women can get involved in such operations, they have a greater opportunity than just food crops, just as they get involved in high cash crops also. If they can get involved in an industry like milk production or egg production where there is a cash flow, then they will have better opportunities.
Great, great. Well, why don't you share a bit more with some of the practices in the region that you see that are contributing to productivity from your experience in Central America? What are some of the promising innovations, whether it's on the science side, whether it's on management practices, feed practices, marketing practices? What are some of the ways that productivity is really helping farmers in Central America?
I just want to start by referring to a small study. Us farmers, when we have been asked to produce more, to produce 100 tons of a certain food, usually in the past and right now we are delivering 110, 120. And that's sense to the tools such as Dr. Norman Burlos put with us, hybrids and all sorts of biotechnology. The story that I had to share with you from Honduras, we were hit with Hurricane Mitch 14 years ago, almost to the day because it was October 31st. And the quickest industry that responded and was able to put an economic flow in the communities was the dairy industry. We then, together with USAID and Land O'Lakes, we put together a program where we developed 40 milk collection and cooling centers in order for them to get access to a better market. The baseline, the production baseline, was 23 producers for each center, and it was 1,000 liters, 1,100 liters of milk for all of them. That's an average of not even 50, or around 50 liters per producer. We scaled down on the facilities that they have. And now, 14 years past, they're producing the least amount is 8,000 liters. Some of them are producing 12,000 liters. So if given the opportunity, if given the opportunity, they will deliver more food and more economic growth for their communities, if given the proper opportunities. We came together with best management practices, with pasture-based production management practices. We came together with better health practices and with feeding programs. And as a result of that, we didn't think that they will grow to 5,000 liters, because we built the centers for them to handle 5,000 liters. Mm-hmm. And they are handling now, most of them are having to rebuild their centers because they are delivering 8,000, 9,000, 12,000 liters. Okay? So in that sense, for us to be more productive, in the next 30 years, the GAP report says that Latin America will be a net exporter of food. And then what we need is the opportunities to be able to produce that. However, as opposed to the last 30 years, we now have social constraints, we have water constraints, we have higher feed costs, we have a lot of biotic things against us. And we need biotechnology. We need the opportunities that biotechnology has. And if you can put a slide that I have, I am using, for example, I need, in order to produce more milk, we need better pregnancy rates in our cows. Okay, and we are, through technology, through the hormone schemes to handle estrous cycle, we are able to get 80% of pregnancy rates. We are using the genetics both from Brazil, milking gear, and both and from the United States or New Zealand, in with the Jersey technology, with the Jersey breeds and the Holland Friesian or Holstein breeds, and we are putting together a crossbreed cow that is able to produce much better under our tropical conditions. We need the vaccines. We need a lot of things that are provided in the animal health industry, just like Jeff mentioned, that enable us to produce 10, 15, 20% more milk or more beef. And we also, where the biggest impact that the biotechnology has is in the animal feed and nutrition industry. We need the enzymes, we need the prebiotics, we need the probiotics in order for us to achieve greater standards of productions, greater effectiveness of production, greater conversion rates, and to be more to deliver better milk or beef or whatever we are producing. I think biotechnology has a role and it's played a role already, but we cannot be denied of the opportunities that biotechnology has to offer, and we cannot just ignore those opportunities that biotechnology has to offer in order to become more effective and to get that 70% that Jeff mentioned out of that 70% extra production needs to come out of a better, not only better management, but also biotechnology.
Thank you. And just a follow-up question. I wanted to ask, I'm curious about how you see, Isidro, this interaction between increased productivity and the potential for improved sustainability on the environment, protection of resources. What's the interaction there?
In order to have access for us, we are, even in national markets, we are now having to be certified. And all these certification processes, one of the things they are looking, us for is for environmental issues. We need to be able to produce in an environmentally responsible manner. We need to be producing in a socially responsible manner. We were not asked for a long time that, even though I think farmers were doing as much as possible, as much as they could. But now, we, in order to get access to market, nationally or internationally, it doesn't matter if it is a staple food like milk, for example. The companies that buy our milk are asking us to be environmentally responsible. It doesn't matter if you're producing staple foods for rice or corn. They have certain standards, and we need to comply with that. And if in the international market is even we are not with the burden, but we have to comply with a lot of laws, with a lot of biohazards, with a lot of things, in order to get access to European markets, to to United States markets or to Middle East markets. We are sending beef to Middle East markets now. And we having to comply with a lot of certification processes that are needed and that we are looking at after.
Great. Excellent examples. Thank you.